Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss. Let's take a
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 95. For some reason in my head, I just heard the intro music going, and I was kind of waiting for it to die down, but I was sort of singing it. I've started editing these things in my head before I actually hit record, so it's I'm sort of doing things backwards here. But today we have long time Little Spoon, short time guest, Miller, all the way from Virginia. How's it going, bud?
It's going good.
Excellent. And then we also have Thomas Kierneck. How do you say your name properly? I know I'm always mispronouncing it.
Tomasz Kierneck.
All right, yeah, that's not going to happen.
There you go. Yeah.
All the way from Slovakia.
Hello, hello.
He's full of beans today. He's full of pistachios, so he's ready to go. Let's see. Let's get the dirty stuff out of the way. So Pennytone is sponsoring us again. It's pennytone.com. You go there and you send your business customers there. Or I guess you could just refer them refer them over there, and then shoot Dave an email, and he will send you their first month's bill ahead. And it is the easy button for VoIP services. So it's a hosted VoIP. They can do their ACD rotations, their hunt groups, their voicemail, all of that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. You just send over that direction. Phones will magically arrive, be configured, and everyone will be happy. And again, that's pennytone.com. So, Miller, you've been having all kinds of issues with your neighbor discovery. I want to hear about it.
Yeah, so apparently in 6.44 in Microtech, they changed the behavior of discovery as it relates to bonding and neighbors. And it's kind of annoying because they assume that if you put the bonding interface in the interface list that you create for the discovery, they automatically include the slave interfaces, and you can't exclude them. And then, so if you have a lot of bonds, and you had a configuration where your neighbors only showed on the bonds before 6.44, well, after 6.44, you have like n times many bonds as you have interfaces or neighbors discovered from your bonds. So like if you had 8 things in your bond, like 8 slave interfaces in your bond, you'd have 8 things in discovery now, which is ridiculous. And there's no way to, well, you should have 9 technically. You should have the bond interface and then all 9 or 8 slave interfaces, but it doesn't come out that way.
So reel back for just a second. What is a bond?
It's a link aggregation bonding, LACP. There's all kinds of different protocols you can run on it, like round robin and XOR, and then straight up just LACP.
So talk to me like I'm 5. What's the advantage of having a bond?
Well, you can use multiple interfaces and bond them together in order to increase your capacity or reliability, or both.
Gotcha. So you make multiple physical interfaces
act as one.
Logically appear as a single interface, right?
Right. Logically just appear as one interface. And for the most part, up until 6.44, Microtech treated that as a logical interface in regards to like interface lists and things like that. So interface lists were introduced recently, which allows you to make lists of interfaces and exclude certain interfaces from those lists. It's really, really cool thing because you can use them in firewall filters and NAT rules and also in discovery. And that's how you choose what you want to listen to, what interfaces you want to listen for discovery packets on, and what interfaces you want to send them on. So that is part of the problem I'm having, is that they've taken away the control that used to have pre-6.44. And basically, they're basically saying the intended functionality is for it to always broadcast on the slave interfaces if you include the bond interface in your interface list.
So I guess what you're saying in simple terms is you've got 2 routers. They've got, say, 2 physical interfaces connected, and then those 2 interfaces are bonded. So now in my neighbor discovery, I see it, I see the adjacent routers. I see it coming from each physical interface and the bond.
You don't see it coming from the bond. You only see it coming from the slave interfaces.
Interesting. I wonder why they chose to... So, previous to this, it just showed up on the bond and not the slaves, and now it's the opposite. It's just showing up on the slaves and not the bond.
Right. And so, if you... I did a lot of testing with this, so there's a lot of use case, like interface ways you can set this up in the lists. So if you only include the slave interfaces in an interface list, it only advertises on the slave interfaces, right? So if you include just one, it just does the one. If you include all of them, it does all of them. If you ever include the actual bonding interface, all the slaves are automatically included, and you can't do anything about it. You can't. So the interface lists have an exclude section where you can say include this interface but exclude these interfaces, right? So if you include the bond and exclude the slaves, what do you think happens? All the slaves show up automatically. You can't do anything about it.
Gotcha.
And their answer to this is you don't do it that way. You just add the slave interface into the interface list, right? Once or whatever. And for me, when I'm looking at my neighbors, I want to know the logical interface that they're coming from. I want to know that they're coming from a bond. If they're coming from a bond, that's great. I know that it's coming over that. But having 8 things in neighbor discovery clogging up the discovery table, it's completely redundant and unnecessary. And it makes it very confusing to figure out exactly what's happening.
Gotcha. And that's not just it's not just problematic in going to IP neighbors and seeing all those extra interfaces. You said that some of your network monitoring systems also...
Yeah, so Observium will do auto-discovery, and it takes the neighbor discovery table and parses it and then tries to add the devices. So when we upgraded due to vulnerability issues to 644 and above, our discovery time really increased because it was now trying to rediscover each one of those devices in the discovery table for every slave interface it had connected. And I use a lot of bonds because I'm pushing a lot of bandwidth. So
is that primarily what you're using it for, just to increase the overall bandwidth?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm doing 20, 40 gig bonds right now. So.
Okay.
Up to 40 gigs.
So I guess in essence, if you've got a couple of microticks or a couple of switches, you're just bonding multiple 10 gig interfaces together to get a lot more throughput. I've seen it too in server infrastructure, usually more for resiliency. Mm-hmm. I guess, than necessarily throughput, right? So your server cluster will be bonded back to your switched infrastructure. That way, if you get a link failure or something like that, especially with like multi-chassis lag, right?
Yeah, so I do a lot of dark fiber, and we'll have a building and dark fiber to the DC for this particular building, and we'll take one wave into one switch, one wave into another switch, and we'll use MC-LAG to pair them together so that we have diversity in the waves and all that, and switches. And then I'll take it into the Microtech. Well, the Microtech then sees that as two different neighbors. So,
which gets pretty annoying. And so you're talking about multi-chassis. That's two physically separate switches, and one device can create a bond between the two, and it still looks like one logical link, right?
Yeah.
Pretty baller. What are you using? Is that the 3064s?
Yeah, the 3064 PQs.
And the multi-chassis lag works pretty well for you on those?
Yes, so far it has. I haven't run into any really issues. You have to do some stuff with Proxmox to get that working, I guess, because I was using Ceph, and Ceph uses a lot of multicast, so you have to add a multicast helper in to make it work right. So,
fair enough.
On those particular switches.
That sounds fun. So you're trying to make as much noise as you possibly can on this, hoping that possibly there'll be some future adjustments to the bonding methods.
Yes, it's really annoying. I went from having, you know, just one copy of a neighbor in my neighbor table to So, you know, I might have like 12 things in there to have in like 80 or 90 things in there because of this. Like my neighbor table on my edge router is gigantic now. It used to be really small. It just makes sense. Why would you have interface lists and have them read in natural English, but they don't operate like that?
Right.
Include the bond, exclude the slaves. Right? You set that up. You set that in the discovery as the list, and it doesn't do it. So how are new users supposed to understand that and think that that's proper? And if they know that it works like that for discovery, is a new user going to think it works like that for, say, firewall filter rules? I mean, it gets really weird really quick.
Yeah.
So yeah. Let me offer my take on this.
Okay. From one rant to the next.
Is this an alternate take? We have not talked about this yet.
This is an alternative take. Yeah, we have not talked about this specifically, so we can discuss it here in detail. So I will compare this to LLDP and CDP. So both LLDP and CDP operate at the link level. So if you have in LLDP this exact situation, you have a bond, and inside of the bond you have 10 interfaces, LLDP will only transmit and receive on the link interfaces, on the actual slave interfaces to the bond. So in this case, actually, MNDP, which is the Microtik Neighbor Discovery Protocol, is now consistent with LLDP or CDP, a link level discovery protocol. So this is a very big difference now. So Microtik basically went from making MNDP run on logical interfaces to run on link interfaces, except only in certain cases. So this is actually a thing that I have talked to Microtik people, I think for like 3 years now, at every single month that I meet them, that MNDP is very inconsistent. So first of all, it acts as...
So what I'm getting is you're to blame for this.
No. So hear me out. What I have been telling them is they have to decide whether MNDP is a layer 3 protocol or a layer 3 discovery protocol, layer 2 discovery protocol, or a link layer discovery protocol, right? And it seems they currently do everything. So before this change, it was a layer 3 and layer 2 discovery protocol. And now it is all 3 at the same time, which just doesn't make sense, because it really doesn't. So first of all, for things like LLDP specifically, since it's a link or a port level discovery protocol, it's not forwarded. So LLDP packets use a special MAC address as their destination MAC address, which is not forwarded on L2. And this is how LLDP works on the link layer. Basically, it's link local discovery protocol, right? LLDP. So if two switches are communicating using LLDP, they will not flood the LLDP or broadcast the LLDP packets to other ports. So MNDP is flooded or is forwarded, however you want to call it, on layer 2, right? Those frames transit across the network, which means it should not be link layer or link local, right? Because those frames are flooded. So in this case, it makes sense that it would work on the logical port and not on the underlying physical ports. But they just changed that. So they changed it to actually be link local, but they still forward the frames, which makes no sense. Pick one, choose one, you know. So either you run link local and don't forward the frames, or you run on the logical interfaces and you are a layer 2 protocol, or you are a layer 3 protocol and you just broadcast. Like, freaking pick one. You know, decide what your neighbor discovery protocol is going to be and make it consistent and make it that way. which is hard because you have legacy issues. You know, now you are completely changing how the discovery protocol works, and you have legacy issues that it works completely differently in older versions, which is not good, again, for consistency, because now a device which is MNDP, you know, Microtik Neighbor Discovery Protocol device, works completely different in 6.45, 6.32, and 5.0. They work completely differently, which...
Isn't the RouterOS version number inside that LLD packet, or that NMD packet? So they could have special use cases for certain versions of packets.
My second big gripe with this, and specifically with the interface lists that you mentioned for Discovery, is that MNDP and LLDP, there is no separate configurations in RouterOS for either of these. You just turn on Discovery. And it makes zero sense, because how do you configure inside of a single interface a link local discovery protocol which is not being forwarded, and a protocol which works on now link local layer 2 and layer 3, which makes no sense. Give me separate checkboxes. What if I want to turn off LLDP and I only want to turn on MNDP? Or like any other normal, or vendor that has had this for a long time, like Cisco, HP, Dell, Juniper, whatever, you know, let me choose if I want to transmit or just receive LLDP or any neighbor discovery protocol information. It is very useful in some use cases to only disable sending neighbor information, but still enable listening for neighbor information. You can't do that with Microtik. So to make my rant short, is Microtik just needs to decide what they want to do with their discovery protocol, and they need to completely separate it from standards-based LLDP, right? And I think then, issues like, you know, new users don't understand what this is. Well, if they just tell you MNDP is a link local discovery protocol that is not being forwarded, and then it just makes complete sense that it runs on links, on, you know, slave interfaces. If they tell you, no, it's being flooded, it's a layer 2 flooded discovery protocol, then that's something completely else. And so, I agree that it's very inconsistent, and it's not good, and especially changing it across the versions is not good. At the same time, I don't have a problem with it being a link local protocol. For example, like you said, Greg, bonding or link aggregation is often used with servers, right? So if you think about it, you want to know which server interface is connected to which switch interface, right? That's the important thing, which cable is going where, which LLDP will tell you, you know, it's link local. It will tell you Ether 5 on the server comes to GE1/0/8 on the switch, right? Sure, that port is bonded, but you don't want to see bond 1 on server is connected to bond 1 on the switch. That, you know, that's not interesting for you. As for the monitoring stuff, with NetXMS, I don't really care, because NetXMS deals with this natively, because it already fully supports LLDP, which is link local, which means that if you use LLDP on a trunk, you already have that neighbor duplicity, so NetXMS doesn't have a problem with this. It deals with this natively. So the monitoring aspects for me, my monitoring system doesn't have an issue with it, but
it doesn't actually it definitely adds like 5 seconds on each core router when it hits it, so it's not a massive like amount of time, but when you have, you know, 500 devices, it does, you know, 5 seconds over 500 devices does add a bunch of time.
Definitely adds up. So. But I think it's it might be, again, due to that inconsistency, you know, when because MNDP being a proprietary protocol, right, when Observium was implemented handling for it, they simply relied on it being a layer 2 discovery protocol, and now behavior has suddenly changed. And of course, that, you know, when you just change behavior from a version to version, and external systems are already relying on that behavior being something, then there is no wonder that, you know, if Observium relies on protocol behaving a certain way and now it behaves completely differently, then there is no wonder that that is going to break things.
Yeah.
So it's
the interface lists act as kind of like a firewall for the discovery, right? So when you configure it, you expect it to work a certain way, but that it doesn't tell you that it's doing this stuff in the background on your behalf.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just really bad.
Yeah, at this point, so after this last change, it makes even less sense as it did before. And as I mentioned, I've been complaining to MikroTik for years now that even before this change, it still didn't make sense. Now it makes even less sense.
Yeah.
It made sense for me before because what you actually chose is what actually happened.
Well, still, so, consider things like this when you enable it on a bridge, right? Do you want to get it flooded to the Ethernet ports of the bridge or not?
I would assume that if you did do it on a bridge, it would do it on Ethernet port. Yeah. So is it going to only do it on each individual slave port of that bridge?
Okay, but yeah.
Is it going to show up as the bridge one time?
Well, exactly.
That's not one thing trying to be a logical interface on another device per se, right? It's only one interface.
So what if you have VLANs then? What if you enable the VLAN interface on top of a bridge?
Then
see what I mean? It MikroTik cannot decide if their discovery protocol is a layer 3, layer 2, or a link local discovery protocol.
Well, I'm pretty sure it only works on the untagged.
No.
You can make it come out tagged by doing things, but if you put it on an interface, the packets are generated untagged.
Yeah, but that's the point. You can do stupid stuff like inject MNDP into a VLAN, which makes zero sense. Basically, if you have 20 VLANs, you could theoretically inject a duplicate MNDP frame into each VLAN on a tagged port.
I run a lot of VLANs over these bonds, too. So in this one particular example, I have one VLAN on the bond, and Neighbors shows up three times, one for the VLAN and twice for the slaves.
It makes zero sense, because if it runs inside the VLAN, it should not, you know...
It's not going to escape the VLAN, basically,
it's not,
right?
But if you have five VLANs on the interface, you get a duplicate... or a five-plicate MNDP packet inside
the VLAN.
So you have
1,000 VLANs on that interface.
And then, I
would be fine with that because then I know the VLAN is working and sometimes you can have problems.
But then you will still get untagged MNDP packet on the bridge itself.
Yeah.
And then you will get...
Per interface, which is fine.
Yes, once per interface. And then you can basically imagine this scenario. You have a VLAN living on top of a bridge, which has physical interfaces and a bond inside of that bridge, and logically a bond has interfaces under it. So at this point, you are sending how many copies of the same MNDP message? Like, that's what I meant, but, you know, by MNDP, MikroTik has to decide what their protocol even is.
That's why the interface lists come in handy, because you say exactly how you want it to show up. So, for example, we've used the CRS 326 switches for aggregator switches, basically, and we made some interface lists, one for customer equipment and one for trunks, right? And so we have a trunk interface, and we use that inside the bridge to add just those interface lists, and then whatever interface you put in the interface list in the interface list section actually as a member goes into that bridge automatically. So it's really easy to move ports around to change where they belong in the system. Well, you can also use that then just to advertise neighbor on just your trunk ports and not have to do it to your customers.
But you see how complicated this gets real fast?
Yeah.
Like with LLDP, it's as simple as saying it's a link layer discovery protocol. It will never be injected into bridges, VLANs, anywhere else. The packets are not flooded, not forwarded on layer 2. It's a link level discovery protocol. It's as simple as that. And compare that to this entire mess that we have just discussed and complicated scenarios and configurations for MNDP, right?
All right. Yeah. Well, I have a thought and a question. So you were talking about how whenever you enable discovery, it's sending LLDP and MDP packs at the same time. And I've talked to some people who operate on like government networks, and they may, for example, want LLDP, but they can't allow MNDP, right? And so the idea that you can't selectively turn, I mean, some of these guys on their networks, that's literally, you know, they talk about what protocols are allowed to be on there or not security wise, right? Because LLDP is this known quantity and this other one is unknown, and so they have to make sure that's off. So I could see that being problematic for some individuals not wanting to run that stuff. But then also, I know, like in a Cisco switch, if I connect a MikroTik and I do show CDP neighbor, I see the MikroTik come up and it's got its information, as well as vice versa on the MikroTik if I go out IP neighbors. So is it, you know, and I'll see the Cisco kit pop in there with like its versioning and stuff. So I'm assuming that's MNDP that's interoperating
MNDP
with Cisco,
is
right?
At a certain level CDP compatible. So CDP can see some parts of the MNDP message and vice versa. The MikroTik neighbor discovery can actually process CDP packets. Or frames.
I want to. You said that LLDP is a known quantity, right? Well, the implementation of said protocol on something may not be a known quantity. Yeah. So, just a blanket assuming that LLDP is fine across the board on every device is not a good idea. And in MikroTik's case, it's. There's no configuration for it.
It could be somebody's got intrusion prevention or detection systems that are examining the LLDP packets and making sure they conform to the standard
devices
and things like that, right? I mean, that it's actually, I mean, because they can look at the packets and say, yes, this does conform to the standard and things like that, and it's not some kind of, you know, foreign injection thing or whatever. Whereas the MNDP, that's, you know, theoretically an unknown quantity and they don't want that on there, but perhaps they could filter that or whatnot. Not to say that, you should trust any vendor's implementation of everything wholesale, but
yeah, I think Roman is really their link level discovery. Thomas, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think MNDP should just go away and Roman should replace it, definitely. Roman has security, it has it is actually a proprietary layer 2 protocol.
Yeah.
So the it's completely MikroTik's own thing. You know, you can encrypt messages, you can forward frames using it. It's Roman is super cool, and just go away from MNDP, replace everything with Roman. I would be completely happy with that choice.
I super like the interoperability with CDP though. I like being able to see MikroTik stuff pop on my Cisco networks.
Well, so. You have LLDP for that. Cisco has LLDP as well.
Yeah, but not, so if you're not running stuff as old as I am, it's LLDP. You know, if you go and buy an older 3550 or 3560, it doesn't have LLDP support necessarily.
All right. Then make MNDP a link local protocol. Do not flat and forward the frames. Just make it a link layer only protocol and offload all the more advanced stuff into Roman.
I thought you were going to tell me not to be so cheap and just buy something that was made within the last 15 years.
Hey, man, those crazy uptimes, you can't just turn it off or reboot it. You have to win the uptime race.
Well, and so, also, like, if you're just doing standard user aggregation, I can get like a 3550 for, you know, $25 or $20 on eBay for, you know, 48 port switch, and most of the time
I prefer the 4948s. Those are nice. $200.
Really nice.
Yeah,
they are really nice. But if you're just
that's our bread and butter right now.
And also, like, their older PoE stuff, if you're using Cisco Call Manager, man, it's so nice to just throw a cheap switch in there. And
call Cisco Call Manager so nice?
No, the interoperability of Cisco equipment.
All right.
So
I
a Cisco phone.
There,
I was going to say, a Cisco phone on a Cisco switch, all that stuff configures so easy. You know, with the voice VLAN and everything, and they just talk to each other and then jump on there and... it makes it so easy. Obviously, who would think a vendor's, if you use all of a vendor's equipment, it would work simply together. But it makes a lot of sense. I've put so much time into Cisco Call Manager that I like it. You know, it's
okay.
It's basically muscle memory. You know, you don't even have to think. You just zip, 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 you know what I mean? Like, if you work with something for 10 years, you're probably going to have some familiarity with it.
Yeah, we just moved to 3CX.
I started using 3CX as well, and there's parts of it that annoy the hell out of me and some parts that are just okay. And so I don't know. You compare it to like a full-blown call manager, there's some missing stuff.
I have some very strong opinions about Cisco Call Manager.
Imagine Thomas having strong opinions about something.
Wow. Surprise.
I'm assuming you've had some run-ins.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I've worked extensively on their 4 series call manager back when it loads on Windows 2000 and uses
I know what you are talking about.
MS SQL, and then their Unity uses Microsoft Exchange to actually store email and stuff like that. It's pretty crazy.
It is very crazy.
But for the most part, call manager just works and works and works. But there's some obviously glaring omissions, like in Cisco Call Manager 4 series, you can't block an inbound caller by their number. Like if somebody's like pestering you, you can't just put their number in there to block. If you're using like MGCP gateways, you have to have like H.263 gateway. You can actually block calls in there manually, but there's no from the GUI easy. I mean, it's like simple things you would think would be there. There's a few of them that are missing. Most of it's there though.
I'll just stick with my asterisk servers.
All right, Miller, while I've got you on here, you use more of the 60 gigahertz MikroTik stuff than anybody else I know.
Yeah.
And you had a few thoughts and opinions, correct?
Yeah, we're finding it kind of difficult to align the LHGs because of their automatic power control that they have.
Is that only in the LHGs?
It's in both models, actually, the WAP60s and the LHGs. It's just more easy to see it in the LHGs because it's more concentrated RF, you know, because of the dish, right?
Gotcha. So the difference between the WAPs and the LHGs is what?
The WAP60s look like a pack of cards, basically, or a really large cell phone from the 90s. And it's basically got an array of elements in there that does beamforming with 60 gigahertz in order to do 2.3 aggregate or 1 gig links over the air up to 200 meters, I guess. And then the LHGs are grids, large head grids with the same 60 gigahertz guts in the front of it, and it reflects back into the dish and then shoots out. And that gets you much further, up to 1.5 kilometers or more. If you're in the desert, you won't have any problems. But to be honest, the 66 gigahertz channeled fifth channel has very little oxygen absorption, like 1 point something per kilometer. So you can go a lot farther, but still a lot of rain fade issues with that. So the problem that I'm having is that when we go to align these things, and even if you use all the fun alignment mode and everything, you never see anything greater than neg 43, neg 50, or neg, not 43, 47. Neg 47 is about the max that you ever see for the signal quality or the signal strength. Typically, it's around 50. So basically, when you're sweeping, you just see these plateaus of, you know, you got crap signal and it's 57 or 50, you know, somewhere in the 50s, and then it goes back down. And so you go back and you go halfway through, and then you start going, you know, up and down the other way, and you try to get an alignment. Well, because it's doing power control on you and hiding what the actual RF values are, it's hard to peak the radios, essentially. And you can look at the signal quality, and you can look at the TX error rate and all these other things that they've allowed you to look at. But what seems to happen is that it's fine for the alignment, but if you reboot the radios and they rescan through their beamforming elements, you come up with a different answer. Hmm. And you can do this a bunch of times, and it's all over the place, but it's always like 50s or 47s or somewhere in that range. But it's very, very hard to get them perfectly tuned in with their 3-degree beam width using beamforming. Each individual beam has like 1 degree of antenna pattern. So combined with the beam forming, it ends up being like 3 degrees, but it's really hard to just get it, you know, on point.
So
unlike a Metrolinx, you can actually sweep and you can see the patterns as it comes up and down, and you can peek those. So
when you're talking about beam forming, explain that to me. What is beam forming?
Beam forming basically looks at the RX level or the probably a bunch of factors with each one of these elements in a grid, and it scans through them and it picks the best one that it thinks based on some criteria. And basically, if the RF beams are bouncing, you know, or going a certain way and bouncing off of things, it's kind of send it back that way because it thinks that's the best path.
Gotcha. You've got an array of antennas and it's intelligently trying to transmit out of those, correct?
Yeah, it's trying to compensate for alignment issues and pole sway or, you know, a grid movement or anything like that.
Gotcha.
While it's sitting there. So
in essence, while you're trying to align this thing, it's trying to constantly compensate, right? And trying to beamform so you're moving it and it's fighting you the whole time, and so you never can quite tell where center is.
That's right? Another part of it too. You can actually lock the TX sector down and do the alignment, which kind of helps on both sides. You still end up with not seeing the true, you know, signal, actual RF levels. It's still controlling the power. There was actually one version or a couple versions of RouterOS that stopped or allowed you to turn off that. You could set a TX power and make it static. And that version you could probably align with. But there have been so many improvements with, you know, RouterOS and these radios since then, it's really hard to go, you know, to want to run that version.
Gotcha. Just for
any
the
length of time. Maybe we just run it for the alignment and then upgrade it right afterwards.
Well, I mean, even then,
we haven't tried that.
They added channels too, right? Since then.
They added, well, it originally came with 3 channels and they had 4th channel, and then you could only get the command line, and then they added it to the GUI. And now there's a 5th channel that you can use, but you can only add it through the command line right now. You have to make a custom scan list added in there.
Gotcha. So there really have been significant, I mean, but they've made a lot of improvements with their interoperation with the chipset itself, right, in RouterOS. So you probably want to stick with the newer versions.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Definitely want to stick. The older versions also didn't expose a lot of the internal state over SNMP. So if you go to older versions, you lose monitoring, you lose even manually in you know, monitor interface, you lose a bunch of data there as well. There's been a ton of improvements to how the beamforming and the chipset firmware works. So
yeah, and they added that alignment mode, which really updates extremely fast. It's really responsive, but you know, if you could just see actual signal strength or the RF level, that would be so helpful.
Yeah, so we need to like 3D print a mount for the front and you put a green laser in there and then you just align it at night? Is that the ultimate solution?
They do come with a little alignment thing that you can click, you can push on to the radios now on the grids. You can look through it and get it, you know, a connection, but that's not good for fine tuning.
I mean, the only thing that's left, you have to align it doing the worst case scenario. So go out there and in the rain, you have to align it in the rain to...
You know, I did that once.
Yeah, it's a little bit stupid.
Because
that's basically the only way at the moment. It's the only way how to know, you know, how that link will perform in the worst case scenario. Because in the best case scenario, the software is just cutting out, you know, the signal quality from you. So you don't know.
Yeah, we had I got a story for that in the rain. it was around lunchtime, and I got a call from our sales guy. He was like, "Hey, this hotel called. They're having a conference, and they need bandwidth like right now. They're in the middle of the conference. It's some hackathon. Everyone's online trying to do stuff, and they only have 300 megs, and they're basically redlining that circuit, you know." So I was like, okay, I'll go over there and see what we could do. So I went over there, did a brief survey. I could see one of our other buildings. And by like 5 p.m., we had them lit with an LHD for a full gig of service. They were blown away. So, and it was actually raining while we were doing the alignment on those radios. Like pouring sheets of rain. So that was fun. It wasn't that far. So we were able to do it in the rain.
Perfect. That's the best possible scenario to align in LHG.
Yeah.
And you had one of your minions hold an umbrella up for you. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, someone was holding an umbrella for me.
Yeah, sort of.
Thanks, Davis or Thomas.
You're welcome.
That's cool. But overall, outside of the alignment issues, anything else that you find particularly interesting?
With the alignment issues comes rain fade issues. So we know certain links have continuous problems, and we've sent people out there to try to realign them numerous times with not much success. And it's, you know, 600 meters, which ought to be fine. The, you know, if you do the free space calculations, there's plenty of margin with the RF to be able to take some rain, but it just doesn't work out. So.
Interesting. It reminds me of how this was a long time ago, but I used to borrow internet from my various neighbors, and so I put a pan tilt zoom mount and put my radio up on that, and so I could just kind of sweep around to find out who had the open access point at the time. And I ended up tying it into an Arduino, and I wrote a little program where it would auto scan looking
and
checking
signals. You did a MUM presentation on this.
Did
I think?
No.
Yeah.
Did I?
Yeah. I think so.
Did I? Maybe. I mean, I could have.
I think you did.
If I did, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was like in Vegas when you went to MUM.
I don't know if I was doing presentations at that point. Anyway,
you did because you remember.
I did do presentations. That's right, because you were there, and I called you out.
Yes. Times.
But yeah. I'm assuming if you're. I mean, there's no such thing as auto-align mounts for inexpensive equipment like this, but that would be interesting. How do you fine-tune these things? Is it... Because I haven't done any of the LHGs.
They have a solid mount now, so it's got the fine adjustment. Now, the solid mount has its own problems. It's got these itty-bitty screws, and it's like a number 7 Allen wrench or something. So now it's like one more additional tool to have in your you know... stuff that you have to carry up with you when you're doing alignments, but they're so small and they have a little bit of thread, and then sometimes when you open up the box, like some of them have fallen out in shipment, so you got to make sure they're all there and tighten them down before they take them out, because they'll just fall off the radios between the office and the spot.
Right.
So we've had to sacrifice a couple of boxes for spare parts because those little screws just disappear. But I do have like. I would say like 200 Allen wrenches now. So
you're gonna make a Game of Thrones throne out of Allen
wrenches? Yeah, I could do that. I was thinking about making an Allen wrench Christmas tree, maybe. You know, with some fiber optic cable in the office. But
good times. Yeah, I've only done the WAP 60s. I haven't done any of the LHGs yet.
We have a lot of WAP 60s out too. So we had our first in the field failure of a WAP 60 out of. Like, I don't know, like, I think I have like 58 of them out. So, just the first one to die. And it was during a lightning storm, so. Yeah, I didn't get a hit that I know of, but maybe a little bit too much static electricity build up during the storm or something took it out. Who knows? It was also one of the first ones we put out, too, so I don't know.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the, most likely time to lose one, right? That or just in the middle of the heat of the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, those things do get hot. They are, the case is like 90% heat sink. So.
Excellent. All right. Thomas, you were telling me about some of the copper 10 gig interfaces, right?
Yeah, so MikroTik has these little... copper RJ45 terminated GBix SFP Plus.
Yep.
And they're neat. They're 20 or $25 a pop.
Yep.
But the really the super nice things is they support 10 gig, 5 gig, 2.5 gig, and 1 gig.
They're 6 gig. They're 6 speed optics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not optics.
I mean copper. Copper.
Yeah. GPIX.
Yeah.
So the super nice thing is they will automatically negotiate it, the highest rate supported by your cabling. And so just last week, we actually plugged in a couple of these and we were running like an ad hoc 10 gig line that we needed while we were moving some servers and doing stuff. Anyway, the point is we had a 30 meter, what is that in freedom units? I don't even know. So, you know, standard maximum Ethernet is 100 meters. That's the maximum Ethernet length. So that's one third of that. So whatever that comes out of.
It's like 90 feet.
All right, sure. So 30 meter Cat 6A cable. But we didn't have Cat 6A patch cables. So we connected the 30 meter Cat 6A cable, and on the both ends of the link, we connected it with Cat5e patch cables. And so the GBIC negotiated at 5 gigabit, and I was like, yeah, that's super neat. It detected that, you know, the whole span of the link is not capable of 10 gig, but still, why drop down all the way to 1 gig if it could sustain 5 gig? And so it negotiated a 5 gig full duplex link. It would actually report in RouterOS and SNMP and everywhere else properly as a 5 gig link. And you know, for 20 or 25 bucks a pop, those are some amazing GBICs.
I believe that if you use two on both sides, you can actually go farther than the Ethernet standards on some of the speeds as well.
On lower speeds, exactly. So it supports, I think, up to 250 meters at 100 meg.
Yep.
Which is like 2.5 times more than the maximum normal Ethernet length, which is also nice for certain use cases. So it's very capable GBIC for that price.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it here in the manual. It says, or the data sheet, 200 meters for a gig.
Ah, there we go.
170 meters for 2.5 using Cat5e or Cat6. UTP, 200 meters for 2.5 if you're using shielded Cat5e or 6, and then 5 gigabit on Cat5, Cat6 is 100 meters, 10 gig over 30 meters. So, yep. They're listed for MSRP of $66. So, if you're getting them for 25, you're getting a good deal.
No, well, that's, you know, distributor pricing without tax and everything else. So
that's pretty baller. Have you used some of those, Miller?
We have about 20 of them in stock. We've probably used them once. So we haven't really had a need. Now they do have that. They do have a new CRS switch with copper 10 gig ports on it.
Oh yeah.
I haven't gotten one of those yet, but those look exciting.
I have two of those on order, and I'm waiting for them to arrive as well. They will become our new, basically, core rack switches.
Very nice. And those things are, that's the CRS312, and those things are, they're saying MSRP is about $600, and what is that?
Yeah, $599, so.
It's like 12 copper 10 gig ports, dual power supplies. I think, although they're shared ports, right? So
there's four combo ports, yeah.
So you can do either or. So that's pretty cool. I wonder if they're still kicking around the idea of kind of a stacking or an MC lag sort of thing with their switches.
So these don't have the 40 gig ports.
Yeah. Did they print something about that in the latest newsletter?
I'm looking at it right now. They
because they had some stuff in the
It's the 326
24S plus 2Q plus RM.
There you go. Well, I wonder why they don't just give them code names.
It's $499.
Like cats, you know, like the panther, the cougar,
the tiger.
There you go.
Yeah.
The house cat.
Puma. This is the Puma.
The Puma. It might get sued by the shoe company. But yeah, that one's... how many is that? 24.
It's SFP literally plus in the port. Name of the router, Greg.
I know.
24S plus.
I prefer to do math. It's you know, keeps me sharp in my older age.
So you like you like counting whole numbers only.
Yeah, right? obviously. Yeah. I don't do decimals.
Or negative numbers.
No. That's those people that believe that the Earth is round and all that stuff.
Let's not even talk about those imaginary numbers.
That's not for me. No. There's no such thing as a fraction. All or nothing, baby. So it's 24 SFP plus slots, and then you've got two QSFP spots, QSFP plus spots, which are 40 gig interfaces. I think you can do the breakout on these, right?
Yes. They sell the cable.
Oh, okay.
They have the cable.
That would make sense then. So the idea is you can plug in a special cable that goes QSFP plus, and then it spits out the four physical 10 gig ports.
That's curious. On a 40 gig port, is it going to show, if you do 40 gig to 40 gig, is it going to show four neighbors in discovery?
Nobody knows it.
I think since it's a physical interface, it'll
probably... Yeah, but it's just four 10 gig waves bonded together in the background.
Yeah, but isn't that all hidden in the optic, or is it not?
Not necessarily.
Who knows? If you use a breakout cable...
You would think when you connect them directly, a 40 to 40, it would just be a single interface, right?
That's
but if you use the breakout, you would think you should see four separate interfaces because you want to configure them separately with different settings potentially. So, but nobody knows because nobody has the Microtik 40 gig gear yet.
And so on the side that doesn't have, like the 40 gig interface side, not the breakout side, does that show us four interfaces in that one?
It should.
Yeah, the
or is it just one? Is it one? Is it a switch?
They just bridge them all together. No, I would think it would show us the individuals, right? So that you could treat them as individual interfaces. I wonder if anything gets a little weird in there. I mean, I don't know. I guess whatever chipset they're using to accept these interfaces is probably doing all the heavy lifting as far as that stuff goes, right?
Yeah.
Complexities hidden there. It's retail, they're saying $499. It's got dual power supplies on that guy as well. So
that's interesting that that's cheaper than the copper 10 gig one.
Yeah, it is. And also, 40 gig seems to be dead now as far as carriers go. So I know, at least here in the States, nobody's going to hand me a 40 gig interface. I can either get a 1, a 10, or a 100. It's all the carriers here have pretty much depreciated 40 gig interfaces. Because I tried getting some pricing just recently in one of our data centers for 40 gig, and they said, you know what, I will give you 100 gig for the same price. So
yeah.
They're basically gone.
This is for internal use for a lot of the ISPs that are using the hardware, right? So someone who's running Microtik would probably be using this inside of their own infrastructure.
Like switch to switch sort of thing.
Or, you know, over
switch to server.
Fiber, you know, because like I have dark fiber and I have the 1310 ports on my muxes, so I could potentially put one of these at every core site and use the 40 gig optics right into 1310 ports and on my east west and create a switched metro ethernet kind of product out of the infrastructure I already have. If I have any
how much
routers.
Equipment do you have in your existing infrastructure that has 40 gig interfaces on it though?
Only in the DC right now, because I just have those 3064 PQs and I have the Intel 710 cards for my Proxmox boxes. So
I think a lot of these are going to find use cases in enterprise and like small racks and like, you know, when you have just 3-4 racks and you just want to interconnect those, like, and home labs, of course, and stuff like that. I don't think this is really a carrier or an ISP-centric product.
Yeah.
I think it's more enterprise data center.
Yeah.
Or small, you know, small scale.
From my perspective, a 3064 PQ is about $300 with a certain fan and fan configuration in it. That's $500. Am I gonna go gray market Cisco or am I gonna buy a Microtik?
And when you say 3064, that's how many 10 gig interfaces? It's like
48.
48, and then it's got QSFP slots, right?
That four QSFP slots.
That you can
so it's literally
break
twice
out.
As many ports and hot swappable power supply and fan modules.
Yeah, yeah. And that I think all the ones I've gotten are already dual power supplied out and ready to go.
They but are, yeah.
This one is too.
Yes.
I mean,
you wouldn't be getting code updates anymore from Cisco for those either, so...
Correct. Like, I think the latest firmware is 9.03.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. And also, this is, I'm assuming, is going to have but much lower power utilization on these.
Definitely lower power utilization. But I would also say that after 10 years of beating on, you know, Cisco beating on the Switch and customers beating on the Switch, there might not need to be anything other than security updates on this Switch. So.
Yeah. And where we use ours, because we have a couple of 3064s as well. I mean, they really are just being switches that only have management access to them. Yeah,
they do layer 3 routing too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty handy.
Yeah, they're pretty beefy. And the what was it? We were rolling back to the 40 gig port. Everybody was speculating the 40 gig meant some kind of stacking or MC lag, which was, I mean, we beat that to death before, but the idea being that you have a higher throughput port that you could daisy chain multiple switches together, right?
So MikroTik's original, before there was even talk about stacking and MC-lag, was the transparent extender. Basically, you would connect these, and the other switch, or the slave switch, would just show as additional ports on the master switch. Completely transparent port extension, rather than running, you know, full-scale operating system, etc. That was the MikroTik's original thing that they teased, and that didn't surface, so I don't know if they abandoned that or not. Mm. I know that was the capability of the chipset itself, so MikroTik wouldn't even have to do anything. They just, you know, you would configure, like, the forwarding plane of the chipset would be configured from a control plane on a different switch. So that one was simple to implement, and so far we haven't seen that. Well, this is the first 40 gig product we really see, so maybe they're still going for the extender idea, or they just abandoned that in, you know, in favor of stacking or MC lag.
Yeah, that stuff happens. And I think Cisco does that with their Nexus stuff. What do they call it? Like fabric extensions or something? Where it's it looks like a switch, but it really isn't locally configurable. It just it's additional ports off the main chassis sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new concept.
No. It still would be quite useful, I think, to have it. I mean, when there is, or if there really is, very little development time investment that MikroTik needs to put into this, then they should do it.
So what do you guys think about the announcement MikroTik did, the 5 gig mobile network stuff they're starting to do over there with like Latvian Telecom or something? Oh, that's what you think about it. Yeah. So it's they're I guess developing some 5 gig like little CPEs for home use sort of thing.
Or you mean fifth generation LTE?
Yeah, yeah, 5G, yeah. Not 5 gig, I'm sorry.
I mean, it just makes sense, right? MikroTik has 4G stuff. They have they even announced the LTE base stations, right? Which since they announced them at the MOM, we haven't heard anything about, and we know that
Intercell, right?
Yeah, it was not going to run RouterOS. It was some just OEM remarketed system that they have not talked about since. So maybe they dropped that. But I mean, for the 5G CPEs, I mean, it's just, I think it's just logical for MikroTik to go there. They have the 4G stuff. They have the VAP 4Gs, right? Those are super nice. So, yeah.
Sounds like they're building an ecosystem of the 5G stuff.
Yeah, the LTAPs are really nice. No.
Also, they said that their new audience system would have a 5G modem built in that's potentially upgradable into the future. So, yeah, they are definitely building a end-user ecosystem slowly but surely.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of an interesting concept. They could actually supply not only the, you know, the customer equipment, but also the base stations for, you know, a country level telecom provider at this point.
To be 100% honest, MikroTik, please stay away from the 5G base station market. Just, you have enough stuff on your plate. Focus on doing what you do well, and everybody will be happy. Don't dilute your portfolio and development power and everything else.
Well, I mean, I'm assuming
they sounds like they were buying it and not developing
it. They probably have some really good connections over there in Latvia. I can't imagine how that would happen. And then they said, "Hey, here's a giant pile of money. Would you like to take this and help us do this thing?" You know, it's probably one of those. Not only is it a lot of money for them, and then probably some secure contracts in the future, but also, you know, in endearing themselves to the local governments and things like that. So,
I see that. We know that they have some very good connections with Latvian Telecom, because I am not sure if it was at their old building or if this is the new building, but I know they built like a, well, of course, a cell site, but also they built a direct link and direct connections to the Latvian Telecom building from there. I think it was their old building. So there is definitely some interplay and some connections between MikroTik and Latvian Telecom, which, I mean, it just makes sense, right? MikroTik is the biggest telecommunications company, or manufacturer, sorry, in pretty much all of Europe at this point, right? So it just makes sense that they would have connections and talk with telco people, and, you know, I think that's just normal.
Yeah. And didn't somebody say they're like one of the highest grossing companies in the entire country over there?
The highest grossing exporter in Latvia.
There you go. So, yeah, I'm sure they have some very powerful friends. Good on them. All right. So while we're talking about MikroTik, man, this is a very MikroTik heavy podcast. Thomas, you posted up RiderOS post exploitation. It was DEF CON 27, I think.
Cleaner Wassel. Cleaner Rassel.
Cleaner Rassel.
Rassel.
Rassel. Did you add an L in there? Rassel.
Rassel. Rassel.
All right.
Rassy. Rassel.
So you, I think, Thomas, you probably got more out of this than anybody else, because some of it was a little TLDR for me, so I kind of was, you know, just kind of scraping through.
I read the whole article. It's very, very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah. It was very good, very in-depth, and interesting.
Well, good. I read parts, and then I would get lost at parts, and then I would kind of come back, and okay, now I know what you're talking about, and then now I'm lost again. So why don't you give us kind of a rundown of what was so interesting about it?
Okay, so basically, first of all, before I start, there is no need to panic, so all of the things that we will talk about are not remotely exploitable. You need access to the router in the first place to utilize any of these exploits, right? So it's more of privilege escalation attacks rather than direct remote code execution. It's not. It's just privilege escalation. And then basically multiple different ways how to persist your escalated privilege across reboots, which is a little dangerous.
He does use an older version to begin with in order to exploit it to get a foothold into the system.
Basically what this is, and this is actually a toolkit that the author of this particular article pulled out, which groups all of the existing MikroTik exploits into a single attack tool, which basically you just give it an IP address of a MikroTik and it will exploit it. Whatever version it's running, it will use the appropriate exploit for that particular version. If it's patched in one version, you know, it knows. So it's a attack, or a rather privilege escalation tool for any version of MikroTik that's out there. He started with an older version to illustrate some points, but there is a privilege escalation exploit even in current RouterOS versions. So this works in every single RouterOS version since version 3.0, actually.
You can also accomplish the same thing if you're running a CHR in a hypervisor. You can create the file that's required or place the files in the file system too, without having to do it this way.
So, when you have access to the file system, you know, you're the king, really.
Yeah.
you just persist files into the file system, and there you go. The point was more of exploiting actual router boards rather than CHRs and x86. What is scary about this, though, is that there were multiple RCE, remote code execution exploits, in older versions of RouterOS. So you could utilize an older remotely exploitable exploit and then utilize these new persistence or privilege escalations and persistence attacks vectors to privilege to root and then persist your exploit across reboots and potentially even further upgrades, which is dangerous. To make it short, it's a super interesting article on privilege escalation and exploit persistence. So what it talks about is it goes very in-depth on internals of RouterOS. It goes very in-depth on basically how MikroTik structures their packages, their file system, how the services are laid out and what is running where and how the services are interconnected, how the init system of RouterOS works, which is super interesting as well, and basically how to exploit it for, as I said multiple times, privilege escalation and persistence. And there is some really clever ways how to achieve persistence in RouterOS, your exploit persistence, so it persists across reboots, because most of the file system of RouterOS is mounted as read-only during RouterOS boot. And so if it's mounted as read-only, even if you are root, you can do anything because it's a read-only file system. But so one of the super interesting ways how the author achieved persistence is that RouterOS supports SNMP, right? And SNMP, the SNMP daemon itself, it has a pluggable architecture. For example, when you have the DHCP package installed, the DHCP package provides some data to the SNMP daemon, right? You have the wireless package, which obviously provides some data to the SNMP daemon. So the SNMP daemon needs to execute external libraries, needs to execute external code to basically load this external data. So what the attacker has done, so how do you make the SNMP daemon load your malicious libraries? Well, just create a custom package. So it turns out you can easily create a RouterOS package which is completely malicious and your own. But you cannot install it from Webfig or Winbox because it validates the signature. It's a signed package, it's supposed to be signed, and it validates the hash, and if the hash doesn't work, it doesn't install the package. But for some reason, MikroTik, in their infinite knowledge, have decided to not validate package signatures when you install package manually as a root from the privilege escalated shell. So you can actually transfer your malicious package, privilege escalate to root, and then install a package which is persisted into the one of the few read-write partitions, which are mounted as read-write by the kernel. And so then you have a custom package which can register a library which gets loaded by the SNMP daemon and executed by the SNMP daemon, and boom, there you have it. You have now loaded your malicious code into internal RouterOS services, and since it's a package, you have persisted it across reboots. Of course, it's very visible, right? Because as a user, if you go to system packages, you now see a package which is something, right? Of course, you could always name it as something that's less, suspicious, but still, it's a package. And so that was like one super clever way how to just exploit the pluggable architecture of SNMP and packages. So just super clever. And then so the article.
Why would you not validate the package if you were installing it as root? Is it just the expectation that nobody should have access to do things as root? I mean, is that the end of
exactly?
Your...
Yeah, probably.
So first of all, you should, even if you are running a root level shell and invoking a utility that installs the package through that way, it should still validate the signature, so MikroTik needs to fix that. But yeah, it's just when you have the expectation in the first place that nobody is executing stuff as root, you know, your expectations are that that is secure, and therefore you put less emphasis on security for the internal tools, yeah. Which here comes to bite us.
I guess it's kind of like leaving all your valuables in the safe in your house completely wide open, because nobody should be able to get into the front door, right?
Yeah, pretty much. That's a concept.
So,
yeah,
so ultimately, what can we do of this? Is it just knowledge that we've gained, or can we use this to, say, install other things on the router, like a zero-tier package or something else? Is someone going to make some homebrew, you know, installation system from MikroTik or something?
Oh, yeah. You basically, what you have gained is root access to a Linux system. That's it. So now it's just
a very proprietary Linux system, though, right?
It doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't matter. It's just Linux. I mean, as long as you can find a compiled binary that's statically linked for the right architecture, which obviously ARM and MIPS are very common architecture. You can find precompiled statically linked libraries.
Yeah, but not Tile.
Yeah, Tile is a little bit of a different story. But theoretically, you can get your hands on the Tile MDE. The MDE is the Tile developer environment, and you could theoretically cross-compile for Tile. It's possible. It's all open source. It would be a tremendous amount of work, but it certainly is possible. And so, yeah, you could definitely run like zero-tier process on your MikroTik router now, because you have that root shell access, right? But that's so, like, the valid use cases are there. It's much more scary for the nefarious use cases, right?
Right.
So can we put, like, you know, like top, htop or something on there?
Oh yeah, you could.
That would be useful. Have a little bit more insight into the process when you're having a problem than profile.
You could, definitely. But you could also just mine Bitcoin on the routers of all of your customers.
Yeah. You know, I recently got a Bitcoin mining machine given to me for free, which tells you something. It's like an Antminer A3, and it's not profitable. I think I would make like $120 a year after paying for electricity to run that thing.
But so, you see, your customers are paying for the electricity, right?
Sure. Yeah. So but it's still not worth like using. It's just the profitability calculator was like, no, you can't make it work. So
I mean, but just like as a thought experiment, right? You are an ISP with 2000 clients, right? Each client has it depends, right? But if they have like a 3011 or 4011, that's like a 4-core ARM machine, right? Of course, if they have like a 450 GX4 or 850 GX4, you know, that's a 4-core PowerPC machine, also quite powerful.
Yeah.
And if you are not paying for the electricity and you put into your customer client agreement that you may utilize their router during times of inactivity for whatever, right? For other computational tasks, so you are doing it legally. I mean, if they sign off.
So you want me to make a Bitcoin, a MikroTik Bitcoin botnet
network
of my own end users?
Well, so you could, right? Just a thought experiment. You could make it legal, because if you put it into your user agreement, then it's legal. You know, each user, realistically, they won't notice, right? You are drawing like 5 to 10 watts of power. So for the end user, that's nothing. You know, that's not even a single light.
So this miner that I got right now would make 85 cents a day, $25 a month, or $306 a year. In electricity, it would cost $4 to run a day, $120 to run a month, or $1,400 to run a full year. So if I ran it for a full year, I would actually lose $1,100.
Well, think about it this
but
way. If, you're not
if I, if I didn't have any electricity, I would only make $300 to do that.
Yeah,
it's still not good.
It's a single miner, right? But yeah, if you have like 2,000 to 3,000 router boards mining, I don't know. I haven't done the calculation. I'm just saying you could. That's the point. You could.
Yeah, yeah. Thought experiment wise.
But yeah, the nefarious purposes are the problem here, right? If you utilize one of the previous exploits to gain access to the router, then you utilize these new exploits for privilege escalation and persistence. You know, you can have zombie machines literally all around the world.
This other mining machine, the S17 Pro, would make $3,000 a year right now after taking into account electricity. $5,444 right now if you don't take electricity into account. It also uses over 2,000 watts of power.
Jeez. So, aren't there diminishing returns on those miners as well? Like maybe
they're all FPGA now.
Yeah,
like this one is 53 terahashes or whatever it's called.
Well, from what I understood, it's like so this THs. Month it may make you, say for example, $100, but next month it'll only make you, you know, $92, and then the next month.
The swings of the market to blame, really, rather than the miner. Theoretically, the miner is outputting a consistent amount of Bitcoin, right? It's the market swings, and when you convert, it's Forex, right, for an foreign exchange.
But at the end of this guy's article, he says, is it all fixable? And he says, of course. Says almost everything I've talked about here has been fixed, can be fixed with minor changes, or could be fixed just by moving away from executing everything as root. So there you go. There's a path forward.
Oh yeah, all of this can definitely be fixed by MikroTik, and they should fix it. They definitely should fix it. And it's not some of the things are more complicated because, for example, when he talks about how init loads libraries and library path, how it's loaded, that's a bit more complicated because you need to load libraries from somewhere, and init needs to run RC scripts from somewhere, and if you have a pluggable architecture with packages and everything else, and you need to have some user read write partitions mounted, some space that users can write to. I mean, it's a bit more complicated, but nothing is undoable with signature checking on every single level, right? With hashing and validation of those hashes, with proper, it's all doable and fixable. Just MikroTik needs to put time into it.
Yeah, and I don't know this guy, Jacob Baines, but I think I want to. His very last line says, "You know, what could they do to fix it?" He says, or maybe we'll just wait for RouterOS version 7 to be released.
So
there you go. The trolls everywhere.
Ouch.
I was thinking, I made the joke that, even these guys just hacking on the boxes are making version 7 jokes. So it's apparently a pretty big meme, I suppose. Although I don't know this guy. Maybe he's a network operator. Maybe he's been working with MikroTik for a really long time. And obviously, he's putting a lot of time and energy into all of these projects. Because he collate a whole bunch of different exploits into a kind of one homogenous tool. So he obviously has
a labor of love right there.
Yeah, he's put a lot of time into the forums and things like that. So I'm sure you see that in every other forum post, something about version 7.
I mean, so I want to say that so this guy has been a thorn in MikroTik's side for a long time, but that's not really the right approach, right? He's actually doing good work. MikroTik should be thankful and should be fixing all of this. We know for a fact that MikroTik, you know, like from the Vault 7 leaks of NSA, you know, we know that there will be people who will exploit these faults and not tell anybody about it and use it for nefarious purposes. So, good job. Thank you, whoever random person you are, and MikroTik, please fix this. And yeah, it's not, he's not doing anything wrong. He's doing everybody a service. He's doing a good thing, and we all should be thankful, and MikroTik should be thankful, and they should fix it. You know, if it's not found by security researchers and published like this, then CIA, NSA, or KGB, or whatever KGB has become now, it's not KGB anymore, but yeah, you know, state actors will utilize this silently and not tell anybody about this, and then there will be a big leak, and we'll find out, oh yeah, they've been using it for years now.
I think it's probably, there's probably some guy working for a government somewhere that worked his ass off to find these exploits, and now this guy publishes it all. He's probably super pissed.
Damn it, all of my work.
Well, they're all already CVEs, so.
Fair enough. Was there no, I mean, there was some, I mean, some of this, some of the, like, the persistent stuff he came up with on his own, though, right?
Yeah, all of the privilege escalation and persistent stuff is new.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, he did.
Like, it utilizes based on, it definitely utilizes based on research into previous CVEs, definitely. And some of the bootsteps he uses to bootstrap the entire process is also utilizing previous CVEs. And, of course, the tool that he released, that aggregates all of these is, of course, also based on previous research and previous CVEs.
Hmm. Fair enough. Well, we're at $1.20, so... Do you guys have any last stuff you want to throw in there before we stick a fork in it? No, nothing pressing. I know you may want to just throw it in there, Thomas, because we glanced over the or glossed over, like really sped through last show. What was it? That was an exploit, the Urgent 11 stuff, and you said it was much more severe than we actually had talked about. Do you want to kind of give the a little bit more detail on why it's so dangerous?
Yeah, I just want to make sure people understand that this is super freaking serious, and they should immediately update anything and everything that uses VxWorks, which might include SIP phones, ATAs, of course, sonic walls, and other IoT stuff.
God, just throw those out, please.
No, I mean, that's an option as well, but if not, then update them. Like, there is no ifs, there is no at least, just update them or you are in serious trouble. So,
well, I mean, didn't you say just packets moving through can be problematic?
Yes. So what the exploit actually was and why I wanted to return to it today is that the VxWorks exploits were actually errors in packet, in very low level packet processing and frame or packet parsing. It works both on layer 2 and layer 3. So it allowed you to completely own any VxWorks box just by sending packets to it or forwarding packets through it, which if you think about is super serious. It's anybody, if you can find a sonic wall on the internet, you own it immediately. It's yours, right? Because you can send a specially crafted packet, which gets, basically executed. It's not supposed to, but it gets executed by VxWorks, and you can basically inject code directly into the kernel, which gets executed, and, the device at that point is yours. So it can be used to proxy attacks into the local networks behind NAT. This is why NAT is not security. It can be just... it's stupid how serious this is. So update or throw out anything using VxWorks immediately.
All right, good deal. All right. Let's stick a fork in it. Miller, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
The Brothers with Slack channel is probably the best way, or you can message me on Facebook. But I'm rarely on Facebook these days.
Yeah, me neither.
It's a cesspool.
I just, I don't know. I don't get any value out of it.
I should say, I don't put much on there because of the privacy concerns. It's, I watched that Netflix documentary, The Great Hack. About Cambridge Analytica and all that stuff. That's really a good documentary to watch, but scary.
Freak you out a bit?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. Don't take any surveys.
You don't want to...
on Facebook, especially.
You don't...
Because they're gathering a profile on you. Not that they don't already have one from everything else going on, so...
Gotcha. Fair enough. All right, Thomas Kernick. If people were interested in the things you do and wanted more information, how would they go about finding that on the internet?
Yeah, the easiest is unimus.net, and other than that, just Google for me. If you want to find me, you'll find me. I'm fairly easy to find. All the social platforms and everything else. But yeah, unimus.net. We have live chat. Press that. Ask for me. I'll be there.
So Thomas is a cam girl now. That's what I heard.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Got if you, to get that money.
Holla. Make it rain, brother. If you want to find me, gregsoul.com or greg@gregsoul.com, you can drop me an email. Let's see. Probably the easiest way to really get a hold of me is via the Slack, and that's you go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You throw us a couple of bones. We give you access to the Little Brothers Wisp Slack, full of like-minded individuals. Somebody's an expert in anything. It doesn't matter how green you are an expert in something. You have something to contribute. There's no such thing as a dumb question, just dumb people like Mike. So throw those questions out. It's so much more fun to give him a hard time when he's here, but he'll ultimately listen to this and reply back. But slide into my DMs there. It's probably the easiest way for me to communicate with people. It really has. Look, I'm a member of, I know this is lightweight, but probably like 6 Slack groups now, and it's just so easy for me to keep track of things. So jump in there. Any questions, comments, anything like that? I am super keen for people to hear this one. I think this was one of our most interesting and dynamic ones we've had in a really long time. So thank you, Miller. Thank you, Thomas, for coming. And hope we hear from you guys soon. Thank you very much.
Bye. We got horrible jokes. We're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts. We're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.